The three most explosive things I know to be true about Phil Mickelson are not in the book. And each of them would have been international news. Like, probably would have dwarfed the Saudi stuff in some ways. But they're not in the book because they were told to me off the record, and I always honor those agreements.
I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
Hello, this is Alan Shipnuck, back for another Fire Drill, joined by usual wingmen Michael Bamberger and Ryan French. We have made a commitment to you, the listener, that we're going to do these every Sunday in perpetuity. It's like a life sentence without hope for parole. We'll have rotating cast of characters, some guests. Obviously, if Michael or Ryan or myself are traveling or out of pocket, we'll mix up the crew. But I think this will be the core, for better and for worse. So we're excited to get this going. We've been, you know, Fire Drill is a new franchise we just launched this year, kind of built around the big events and breaking news, but felt like it's time to commit to a weekly podcast for you, the listeners, who have been so loyal and showed so much fidelity and concern when we're not on the air. So here we are. Boys, how do you feel about this new endeavor?
Michael gave it a fist up. I really give a lot of credit to the Blade, Frank Licklider, because it really went sideways and really in a good way sideways. And that led to that we should do this all the week. So Frank, if you're listening, I'm sure he's a big fan. Yeah. We know he is. Thank you.
Just to summarize, Michael, this is a medium that most people listen to. So when you hold up like a clenched fist, it's cool, but they can't quite hear it.
Yes. This would not be good for the Marx brother who didn't talk. Was that Harpo?
I think that was Harpo.
Bad medium for him.
But I saw it was actually, I think today's the anniversary, 50-something years of, was it Tommy Smith and John Carlo holding up the raised fist on the Olympic podium?
Yeah.
I know they're heroes to you and me as well. But we appreciate that homage.
Yeah, there's a children's book out that's supposed to be very good about that whole period of our history. It is powerful.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I mean, and there you go. People who say, "Oh, I don't like politics in my sports." I mean, go back to the Berlin Olympics with Jesse Owens. You have 1968, everything that transpired, Muhammad Ali on down the line. I mean, politics is always part of sports, and I think it's naive to wish it was any other way.
Can I just make a quick golf note? Well, a quick life note about that 36 Olympics. I knew well a man who remembered well, and Alan, I'm sure you would have met him along the way. I know you did. I knew well a man who remembered well because he was there in person, the 36 Olympics in Berlin. And that was Sandy Tatum. And he was 16, and he recalled it for the rest of his life because he had just the great Jesse Owens and Hitler in the same stadium. And he said the sound that the fans made was terrifying. So with respect to people who have that view, you know, don't mix politics with sports. I get it on a level, and it's completely unrealistic on another level. And the way we talk about golf right now, not to get too sober too quickly, it's completely unavoidable, I would say. We avoid it where we can, but when it comes up, and it comes up a lot.
Yeah. Sandy Tatum, I haven't thought about him in a little while. I actually had the great joy of playing Cypress Point Club with Sandy, and he was Hideki Matsuyama before it was fashionable. He would, at the top, he would pause for like 2 seconds. It was unbelievable. And when we played, he was in his early 80s. Of course, Sandy Tatum was a former USGA president, and he's a guy that got Harding Park redeveloped and turned into a championship venue, and just one of the great figures in the game, and had incredible head of silver hair, and he was a lawyer and just an incredible orator. I mean, his command of the English language is like, rivals Winston Churchill, I would say. He was just a towering figure. And to play CPC with him, and he was a member, and it was a labor of love. He was really involved in that place. And that's an all-time golf memory for me.
Yes. Well, Alan, since we may not get that many opportunities to bring up Sandy's name, although, as you say, if we do this in perpetuity, we'll have plenty of opportunity. He's also responsible for one of those famous golf quotes of all time, 74 U.S. Open, which was, I would say, almost literally like when I first sort of fell into golf. But I didn't know this quote at the time, but later became famous. I think it's been improved a little bit over time. And guys are shooting 1,000. I think Kaylor won one with 7 over. I'm not sure, but it was a high score.
Yeah, the massacre.
Yeah, the massacre of Wingfoot and Sandy was not the president of the USGA, but champion of the committee. I'm sorry, chairman of the championship committee, something along those lines. And he said, "We're not trying to embarrass the best golfers in the world. We're trying to identify them." And that was when the USGA was the USGA.
Yeah. What would Sandy Tatum think of a 2-hole playoff to decide the US Open? It's so bizarre. Either be sudden death or go to 4 holes, which is a hefty amount of golf. But 2 holes, it's how'd they settle on that?
Ryan, this is also the guy during another U.S. Open. Guys, there was, do you remember the name Lon? Well, Alan would definitely know the name. Ryan, even with all the names you know, do you know the name Lon Hinkle?
Of course, yes. Random golfers.
Yes. So Lon Hinkle. Was it at Inverness? I think it was Inverness. Took a shortcut by teeing it up on a pencil and playing the wrong fairway and turning a par 5 into a par 4. And Sandy planted a tree that night, so he couldn't do it. And then Hinkle did do it. I've told the story wrong. At first, he did it with a regular tee. Then Tatum planted the tree, and then Hinkle did it again with a tee. He teed it up. He put the ball up on a tee. And guys started complaining, you're changing the course. And Sandy said, "We're improving the course."
I mean, imagine trucking in a tree under the cloak of midnight and planting it, and guys show up the next day.
That is amazing. Like, how big was the tree?
It was like a 60-foot spruce. It was big. The Hinkle tree. His obit ran in the Times a year or two ago, and it made reference to the Hinkle tree. It's along with the Eisenhower tree, and some people are still sitting shiva for the Eisenhower tree. It was one of the great trees in all of golf. But we digress. Alan, what would you say, Alan and Ryan? Ryan grew up on a course of very few trees. Alan, do you have I'm sure you love the Pebble Beach tree, but do you have a favorite tree in golf, Alan?
Well, of course, the tree in the 18th fairway at Pebble died. And when I was working there in the 90s, was I working there? No, I guess I'd already left, but it was mid 90s. They trucked in a new tree to get it down to the 18th fairway. It was the most amazing piece of machinery I've ever seen. It was a semi that had about 100 wheels, and they could incrementally change the direction of each. So this semi could do these S turns to get through the lodge area and get down to this very tight compact space. And it just moved a foot at a time. It was incredible. And I like that tree. I like the tree off the 14th hole of the Dunes course at Monterey Peninsula, but it's probably Ghost Tree, up Abandoned Dunes. And I was just took my, well, as you know, I took my kids camping at Sequoia National Forest, and there was this incredible dead tree. I took a photo, and I need to send it to the Uncle Tony group chat because it looks exactly like the Ghost Tree. But what about you, Ryan? Are you an arborist?
I mean, I'm going to bring some, I feel like my job on this podcast is to bring some, the common man, just Pebble and Monterey Peninsula. There used to be 3 shitty trees in the center of 16 fairway at the Alpena Country Club. Okay. And it wasn't we didn't have fucking S-curve semis coming. Bob, the superintendent was probably making $25,000 a year, took his chainsaw out there and cut them down like a normal person does because they're stupid. They're in the center of the fairway, but they were very iconic because you used to ring the bell in Alpena terms, iconic. There was a bell hanging on it. And so you had to wait for the bell to do it. And I was playing in a high school match and someone hit the bell that I was playing with.
That's so awesome.
I mean, my God, you guys are people are coming in the middle of the night. They have S-curve things. Look at Michael's making notes about that bell right now. Look at him. I mean, I've talked to Michael for 12 hours over the last 8 days, and he's making notes again. The man never stopped.
Yeah, I was just going to note, Ryan, tell me if this is not correct. Was your maternal grandfather not an arborist among his other among the many other things he was in his life?
He was.
And Alan, as widely read as you are, may not know the book. Ryan's mother is a Eustace, and Ryan's maternal grandfather, his mother's father, was Obie Eustace. And he's the author of this remarkable book called Notes from the North Country. Is that working?
Yeah, that's working. And,
a lot of trees in this book. Alan, the family ate muskrat in their youth. Listen. Muskrat is a black, oily, disgusting, repulsive meat.
Yes.
Very, it was baked. Like, at least, like, if you put it under an open fire, you could maybe kill some of the flavor and replace it with something else. But they didn't do that. Dude. They just baked it. It had black blood coming out of it. It's actually amazing that Ryan made it this far.
I feel like at this point we should offer a mission statement for this podcast, because I'm sure the listeners are totally perplexed. Like, this is like Seinfeld. It's like a podcast about nothing.
You mean the listener, period. Singular.
Yeah.
My mom, who religiously listens to everything I do, is like, well, that's my dad.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think our vision for this podcast, we're going to recap the week in golf. Maybe we'll look ahead to what's coming, but obviously there's going to be some unexpected detours. And by the way, to those listening at home, we do not talk in advance about any of this stuff. There's no game plan. No. I wouldn't say there's no thought, because we were thinking about golf all the time, three of us, but we just press record and freewheel it, which is probably too apparent right now.
Alan, are you aware that Ryan's mother, the former Ginny Eustace, is just finishing, and she's probably at the point, as so many of us have been, where she's slowing down because she's about to finish Phil, the unauthorized biography of Phil Mickelson.
Well, this is another thing that you don't know, Michael, is Alan and my mother had a conversation today, just like you and my mother. Alan called me and my mom was there, and the thing. Enough about my family, because Lord knows we're going to talk about that at some point down the road.
Let's talk about Phil. I mean, this is in the golf media landscape. That was one of the big developments of this week, especially in our world, because he's over in Saudi Arabia. This is a big moment for LIV Golf. They're on the home soil, essentially the motherland, if you will. And a reporter asked Phil a softball question. Basically says, "Oh, you had some spicy things to say about Saudi Arabia and its people. You know, now that you're here, what are your feelings?" Now, obviously, the politic thing to do, maybe the old Phil Mickelson, when he used to be smooth and a master publicist, would have said, "Oh, I love it here. The people are so gracious and wonderful." Instead, this is what he said. Jake Muldowney, our producer, roll the tape, Jake.
Made some comments about this country last year, which you've apologized for. I just wondered how you feel about now you're here. Have you changed your opinion?
So I will reiterate, I never did an interview with Alan Shipnick, and I find that my experience with everybody associated with LIV Golf has been nothing but incredibly positive, and I have the utmost respect for everybody that I've been involved with.
So that's what Phil said. And obviously, it was a weird non sequitur, but I was camping in Sequoia National Park when this happened.
No, that's what I need to know, Alan. Yeah. Alan, let's stop right here, because no one could get a hold of
no cell
phone, right? With the fire pit group chat, and for people that have getting Alan to have any good sort of service in anything is quite a miracle. The fact that he had none, I have to know, when it came to when you finally found service, was it just like your phone had to be like starting the
dashboard? It's even better than this, because this camping, my kids are on this, they have a week break in the middle of October every year. And so there was a lot of talk about what to do, what not to do. Anyway, make a long story short, this camping trip was very, very last minute. So it was an extremely hasty departure, and trying to mobilize four kids and a dog and all the gear, because it's getting cold now, you know, it was in the 30s at night. And so as we were doing that and changing cars and everything, I couldn't find my phone. And so I said, okay, we can't leave on this trip until I find my phone. And everyone looked for like 30 minutes and all the cars in the house, we could not find the fucking phone. And my iPhone was off. I guess my ringer was off. And finally I was like, well, okay, we got to go on this trip. I mean, we got a 4.5 hour drive. Let's go. So we left my phone behind. So I had no phone and no service. And so, but as we were driving up, you know, all my kids have phones, of course, they're all teenagers. So I was using my son, Ben, and my daughter, Olivia, I was using their phone to make calls and I was texting people. And so, and Matt Janella was one of them. So we camped for 2 days and we're driving out of the mountains and you finally get service. And I can't remember, one of my kids had a text from Matt saying, call me immediately. I was like, oh, this sounds sort of serious. And so I called Matt. I was like, hey, buddy, what's up? And he's like, wow, you picked a great time to go to literally disappear into the woods. So I was very slow to learn about it because not only, even when I got service, I didn't have access to my Twitter because, of course, I don't know my passwords. It's not on my phone and all this and that. So it was wild.
Where did you find your phone? Did you find your phone and how many roughly text messages did you
get? Well,
have?
So eventually we pulled, when we stopped for dinner, I did have my laptop. Like I always bring my laptop just in case. Oh, like okay. If Tiger has another car accident or something, you got to be ready. It's kind of like a surgeon, you know, you get your beeper just in case. So I had my laptop. So then I was able to get into my iMessage and I don't know. It was hundreds of messages and you know, so many Twitter notifications and all that. And It was so jarring because for like the first few hours when I was on that trip, I was all twitchy because I didn't have my phone. You know, we're just so used to checking it. And but it was great. It made me enjoy the serenity of the nature. And it was a blissful break. And then to walk right into this shitstorm, it was like, oh, my God. So
I assume you knew as soon as you saw the clip, Alan, that he was just trying to like play word salad, right? Like you didn't think that he was denying that he ever talked.
Right. I mean, that was just Phil. You know, he's always working in the edge. He's always got an agenda. And so, it's just semantics. He's saying, well, it was an off the record conversation. Therefore it doesn't count as an interview. And he said, you know, we never had an interview or whatever. So yeah, that was, of course, Phil knows we spoke many times, in fact. So, it was bizarre. We're going to open the floor up to Michael because in my absence, Michael jumped in and wrote a very thoughtful column that kind of explained the whole situation, I thought, expertly. And I was deeply grateful. And that thing had already posted by the time I came back into civilization. So it was like, I really missed the whole thing. But Michael, why don't you summarize your thesis for those who haven't read your story? Like, you know, what is your take on the situation?
I'll be happy to do that. But Alan, just so that people who are students of Alan Shipnuck's cell phone troubles know, what was the height from which you dropped your cell phone at the 2018 Ryder Cup in Paris? I think you were in a bleacher, maybe a drop from a bleacher. I'm not sure what happened.
Right.
I know you were. There was lack of cell phone frenzy that week too.
Yeah. So this was, of course, that was a freighted Ryder Cup because I'd made the prediction that the U.S. was going to embark on this long-term dominance and all of Europe hated me already. And so it was already a week where I needed my phone.
I think they'd love to hate you, Alan. I would differ.
Yeah, right. Correct. It's all part of the fun. But it was the opening match that, you know, Friday morning, and me and some of our former golf.com colleagues were up in the bleachers and it was like, whatever, 30,000 people. And it was totally nuts. And like the first few shots of the Ryder Cup had been hit, and I don't know if Dylan DeCherry, who's standing next to me, he kind of bumped me. I don't know. Something happened. I dropped my phone. It fell about 12 feet and landed face down on pavement. And it was like, you know, you're just afraid to turn it over. And it was just completely spider webbed and unusable. I did find a place in Paris. It was open late that night and they gave me a new screen. So I was really only out of commission for one day. But yeah, I love / hate cell phones.
I would guess, Alan, the French don't take kindly to upset Americans who desperately need their cell phone fixed. Maintenant.
Yeah. No, so the guy said he needed an hour. I was like, great, I'll go have dinner. And actually I had to,
Alan, they'll say, an hour? That is not enough for a papa dinner. Exactly. You're revealing yourself to be, I'm not saying you are, the vulgar American. You had better get into the soup course.
How? Well, and that whole week, the logistics, I wound up on a bus. I went to the wrong place. It was a mess. But I came back after dinner and he wasn't done. And it was a long dinner. It was probably almost 2 hours. And I just looked at him blankly. Like I was bereft of any emotion at that point. And I just said, I'm just going to sit here and wait, which I think was also an affront to the community.
That is smart.
Quickly Googling bereft real quick. And then I will come back and have something to say.
Ryan, have you ever been to France?
No.
The McDonald's milkshakes there, I swear to God, they're like a shot glass. They're so small. It's a joke. Alan, I thought it was bizarre. I imagine that and I want to emphasize imagine. I don't know. I can't pretend to know what goes through Phil's mind. I imagine, you know, he's over there in Saudi Arabia. He's dealing with Crown Prince and this guy and that, not Crown Prince, but all level of royalty. And he's like, I never talked to the guy. You talked to him. Well, I never got interviewed by the guy. So now he's doubling down on what he's already been saying all along there. He's looking for cover, as you know, as somebody else, not I, observed. If you were collecting hundreds of millions of dollars from these people and you were in their country and you know what they've done to Jamal Khashoggi, yeah, you're going to be pretty careful about what you say. I think, you know, it's upsetting, actually, because he must know on some level it's disingenuous.
Oh, yeah.
It's too clever by half, as we said in a headline. And, you know, is it any big deal in this grand scheme of things? No, but it leaves a bad taste in your mouth. And it kind of does remind me, I mean, I'm really sort of going off. Let's get back to the main thread here in just one second. But Phil, let's help me with the order, Alan. What came first? The Kiowa win or Phil going in the booth at Harding Park?
Harding was August of 2020. Kiowa would have been May of 21.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, let's forget about winning the PGA Championship at age 50, which is a remarkable achievement with, you know, Brooks Koepka breathing down your neck. But he went in that booth and he showed what kind of talker he can be. He could have been the most entertaining golfer in the history of golf talking. So you know what he is capable of. I mean, he's a very bright person. He's a very verbal person and he's very knowledgeable about golf. So for him to willfully use six words or whatever it was to willfully distort the situation and make it worse or help his own cause, you know, it's off-putting to me.
Yeah. And it's also bad PR because given the point of that question was trying to say something nice about the Saudi people. Instead, he created basically a 2-day news cycle about how disingenuous he is. And reluctantly, I had to get back on Twitter and, you know, defend myself and point out all of the Mickelsonian bullshittery that, you know, that was had been hangs over this whole situation. And people had to weigh in about Phil. You know, Brandel Chamblee had some very strong and accurate things to say about Phil's lack of honesty. And, you know, again, the whole point of that question in that press conference was to spread some goodwill about Saudi Arabia and live golf. Instead, Phil made it all about himself and it forced us to reexamine, you know, how duplicitous he can be. So it was just like, not only was it inaccurate and lame, but it was self-defeating because he made himself the story again and he dredged those comments up again. It was like, it was how not to conduct a press conference 101.
You know, and of course, can you imagine Tiger in a million years? Like, you know, when the Haney book came out and he disliked it so much, he did everything in his power to make sure that the words Hank Haney's book never came out of his mouth. So to your point, Alan, pardon me, he did the exact opposite here. But just that, you know, I hadn't thought about this until just now. The fact is, he said to you, you know, regarding the Saudi regime, they're scary motherfuckers. And now he's in their country. Well, they are scary motherfuckers. By the way, I'm sure we have scary motherfuckers, not to keep using a profane, really distasteful phrase. But now he's going to do whatever he can to run from it. Why not just own it or not even bother, as you say? So.
Well, I have a really funny story. I was going to save this for my book I'm writing about all this, but it's too good not to share. The number two guy at the public investment fund, you know, who's basically floating this entire LIV Golf, and he's very hands-on. His name's Majid. And I went up and talked to him at LIV Bedminster. I really wanted to do an interview with him. And he shook my hand. He said, oh, yes, I know you. He said, you know, when the quotes came out, I called Phil and I said, Phil, I'm the only Saudi guy you've ever talked to. Am I really that scary? And I mean, he was very disarming and very charming. And, you know, that he showed some grace and that, like, that was well played by him. And so anyway, that really makes me laugh. Ryan, you said your mom's reading the Phil book. So, you know, we're all way too close to this, but she's a golf fan, but she's not on the beat like the rest of us. What is her impression of Phil Mickelson now that she's, you know, pretty much read the whole book? I'm just curious.
Yeah. My mom is was a very big, you know, Phil fan, end of story, like a lot of people. And, her exact words, I think I texted him to, you know, in the group chat was, you know, it really pulls on my heartstrings and my mom is very verbal and very in touch with her feelings. She just said, you know, I feel like I've been fooled for a long time. And then, you know, she said the book has many nice things, but we have seen the other side. And so you question even the good things, you know, and I mean, back to your point, guys, I just don't get PR people. And if someone told Phil to say that, or Phil just did it on his own, I don't understand it. I mean, Harold Varner has had the least amount of crap taken because he just put out a statement that he was going there for the money. End of story. Like, if Phil just came out and said, yeah, I said it, I was scared and I was out of money, or whatever the reason was that he was going, this would all have been gone all over. And now, like you said, he's brought it up again. I don't understand why he does it to himself. Like you said, Alan, it was a simple question. It had nothing to do with you. He loses the PR battle because then he has to come back and say to Bob Herrig, like, yeah, I didn't mean it like that. I meant it that, you know, it was off the record. We're just going to have to disagree. I just don't understand. And it feels like, this is hard to say on one statement, it feels like he didn't learn anything from what he's gone through. Like you made a mistake. You made a terrible mistake. Like, how did you learn from it? It's kind of mind boggling to put himself in that position. It really is.
Yeah, that's well said.
Here's what I'll say about do you want to talk more about Phil? But I will say, I don't know. Did you guys watch any LIV Golf this weekend?
You know, I never watched the live stream. I am curious. I click on the scores because I'm probably more interested than most people. And this is a good segue. I mean, Brooks Koepka won the tournament over there in Jeddah. And so this was interesting. I posed a question on Twitter this morning, and I just said, you know, this is a future Hall of Famer. He's had all kinds of injury and other issues for 2 years. He finally wins again. He's found his game. Like, this should be a huge deal. Like, this should be a big story. And I said, you know, to you, the golf fan out there, like, how much significance do you assign to this Koepka win? And it's over 2,000 comments in a matter of a few hours. And I've scrolled through most of them. And the overwhelming majority of people have said zero, less than zero, none at all. And it really, you know, it's sad for Brooks, because if he did this at a PGA Tour event, it would be really celebrated. It's like the return of the king. I mean, this guy was the most dominant player in golf for a couple of years. And he stared down the great Tiger Woods at the PGA, and he beat Dustin head-to-head at Bethpage, and he conquered Shinnecock Hills. I mean, these are back-to-back U.S. Opens. Like, that is a solid gold resume. He's obviously got this weird kind of brooding charisma. I mean, have Brooks Koepka back as at the top of the game is huge for golf in an alternate universe. But the utter lack of apathy out there from golf fans was quite stark.
Well, that's because they know what Brooks Koepka knows, which is 54 holes, easy course, 48 players, no cut, is not the same thing. I mean, we don't know Tiger's true state of mind ever about anything, but we've watched Tiger, you know, and since he was a teenager. He's a super realist, and he has to know that 2019 Masters, it was a great, great victory. Any victory is, you know, played honestly is a great victory. But it was handed to him. He must know it. And he was choking like a dog when he played 18. So what can Brooks Koepka even say about himself 54 holes in that situation? That's not tournament golf, as your 2,000 people who responded today know it. So if you were in the business of awarding points to it, it's something. I'm not saying it's nothing. Of course it's something. But what is it really? I wouldn't even know how to begin to judge it.
What's your take, Ryan?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, agreed. Two things. I watched 10 shots and two things struck me. One, and I mean this very honestly, zero fans. And I don't mean like there was 100 fans. I mean zero fans, which was stunning. It is their home country. I just assumed that the fairways would be lined by everyone just saying, you have to get out there. I mean, I'm talking zero fucking fans. I mean, zero. Like, players not raising their hand to anyone. There was no one there. It was unreal. Unreal. And the second thing is, like, what has hit me is that leaderboard was really good and no one cared. I mean, that leaderboard had Sergio, DJ, Joaquin Neiman, Matt Wolf, Brooks Koepka. A, two things. One, no one cared. And B, 36 months ago or 24 months ago, no one in a million years would have thought that that leaderboard would be on any other tour besides the PGA Tour or some affiliation of PGA Tour, major or European. It is wild time in golf. I mean, that is a really good leaderboard. If that leaderboard was at the Sanderson Farms, people would be freaking the fuck out. I mean, freaking out. And no one cared. Like, in general, you know, no one cares. It's a wild thing. And I don't know how Liv overcomes that. I just don't.
Yeah, that's that's clearly their challenge is, and Michael's made this point before, the fans don't care about the money. If anything, it's off-putting. And so that's what they're hanging their hat on, you know, oh, these huge numbers. But I don't know. That's a fundamental question for them going forward. But I will say, I probably give it a little more credence because I've been at these live events and the guys are playing hard. I mean, there is a certain energy out there. So, I mean, for Brooks to get it done, and you're right, it was not Oakmont, but there was winds were blowing hard from everything I've read and all the highlights I've watched. And, you know, he had to play some golf to win it. So it just, again, we're not going to know until we get to Augusta what it all means. But when we bring all these players together and we have a measuring stick that's accepted. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, the live stuff is inescapable because over on the European Tour at Valderrama, which is really one of the best courses that they play, Adrian Utegui won the Andalusia Masters. Pretty big, you know, pretty nice event on the European Tour. Now, he has been traveling on two passports this whole time. This guy played the first three live events, but the European Tour, you know, there's this court case going on. Are live players going to be allowed to play on the European Tour? That's not going to get heard until February. So in this interim, the live players are able to compete on the European Tour. And so Utegui has basically, after three live events, has gone back to the European Tour. He's played there. I think this was the ninth event since the summer. And he wins his fourth time on the European Tour. He's a very legit player. And so, you know, the courts, I guess, will decide his future. But he's been double dipping, which I guess more power to you if you can get away with it. But and of course, that's the nightmare scenario. And the European Tour gave him very little coverage, even on their own website. You know, in the end,
now,
you
couldn't ignore him. What would be his status for the Ryder Cup, Alan?
Well, again, that's going to be decided by this court case because he's clearly still a tour member. He's fulfilling his obligations of playing the minimum number of events. And, you know, that's also under judicial review. So we don't know. He's in the top six now among the automatic qualifiers. I mean, he's in the mix without a doubt, but we don't know what it means. So, but he got world ranking points. He got the money, he got the exemptions, and it gives him a strong position depending on how this court case is resolved.
I wonder how Liv feels about him playing on the European Tour. You know, I mean, they're very much like everybody against us against the world.
Yeah, but Ryan, that's a great question, Ryan. But I would say just on instinct alone, if a Liv player can play his way into the Masters field on world ranking points alone and make things awkward for Augusta, they would welcome that. Don't you think, right, Alan?
Yeah, and his status going forward with Liv is unclear because he played the first three events and none since. He's not listed in the field for the big season finale at Trump Doral. So, you know, who knows what's going on behind the scenes? I was trying to get some answers and no one would tell me what his status is for the future. So this guy, if the court case goes against him, he could be in no man's land where, you know, he's burned his bridges at Liv for whatever reason. He's barred from the European Tour. I mean, he'll always have Asia. But, you know, it's like this is a high stakes gamble and it's going to be fascinating to watch it play out. So,
Alan, you know, is that Doral field only open to guys who have played all the Liv events, or are there some guys who have not?
No, because people have come online at different times. You know, Cam Smith hasn't played them all, but he'll be there.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Right.
You know, there's this whole year is a beta test for Liv, and everything's just, I mean, one of their people told me, like, you know, we're flying the plane as we build it around us. And so, you know, we'll see how that final field shakes out.
This is Michael knows who's in the field. He's got his Gleeks t-shirt on underneath that fucking button up. We all know you are a huge Gleeks fan, Michael. Is that what they're called? The Gleeks? Isn't one called the Gleeks?
Gleeks. It's a C, not a G.
Oh,
my team is the Niblicks, Ryan. I think you know that.
Oh, that's right. I apologize. I apologize to the Saudi prince for calling them the Gleeks. It's definitely the Cleeks.
That would honestly be better. Like, they got to go, you know, the names are so silly. Like, the merch on that would be off the charts. Could you imagine? Like,
oh my God.
That's your best idea. Yeah.
Quick shout out of an odd kind to our colleague and friend, Bob Harrig, probably the only reporter who's been to all the Liv events so far. Would that be correct, Alan?
I think he skipped.
He went to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, he was. So Bob and I had a lot of correspondence. You know, I like Bob. He's such a good person. And he had this Tiger Phil book that came out right around the time of mine. And whatever, there's always like a little rivalry or spiciness there. But Bob's been, he's a dogged reporter. He's done a great job with all the Liv stuff. And, you know, credit to him. He tracked down Phil the next day and he got those quotes that kind of semi-clarified the whole thing about his comments over there about me. So yeah. I believe Bob skipped one of the domestic events, either Chicago or I think it was Chicago, but I think that's the only one. But yeah, he was in Thailand and he was in Saudi Arabia. So I'll be, you know, I texted him. I was like, how's it going over there? Because the whole question, and I thought really long and hard about making that trip, was what kind of access would there be? And my frustration, you know, I covered the first three Liv events and then I went to Chicago. But my frustration has been institutionally, they're shutting guys down who won't speak. Like, I've had a number of people say to me face to face early in the season, yeah, I'll sit down with you. Yeah, I'll do your podcast. Yeah, I'll talk to you. And they come back and like, oh, it's not a good time. Like, oh, maybe at the end of the year. And so I finally went to some of the Liv folks. I was like, what the hell? And they're like, yeah, we're kind of, you know, we just want to get through this season and we're just trying to turn the temperature down on things. So they basically, there's been this chilling effect that's come from the executive committee and whoever else. And so for me to go to the tournaments, if I can't do interviews, it doesn't make any sense. So I kind of stopped going.
Are you going to Doral?
No, I'm not going to Doral because that's the week of the Uncle Tony Invitational in Bandon Dunes. And again, I thought really hard about it because, you know, I had some interactions with Trump when they were at Bedminster and he's going to be part of this book. And it is the season finale. But again, if I can't do one-on-one interviews, you know, I can watch the highlights and I can read the press conference transcripts. I've been told that things are going to loosen up once they get through this first season. So, you know.
Seriously, the concert that they're going to put on is fire. I mean, fire. They are spending more on concerts than they are on Brooks Koepka. They have Snoop Dogg, Travis Scott, Michael, Travis Scott. Yes or no? Yeah. Know who he is? Sure. My God.
Yeah.
Michael, real quick sidebar. Michael and I are driving to the, did I tell this already on this podcast? I don't think so. Driving to Philadelphia. Michael says, tell me some songs that define you. And we listen to Eminem, Michael Bamberger and me jamming out to Eminem. But Travis Scott, Snoop Dogg and the Chainsmokers. I mean, I literally put out a tweet that replied to them announcing it. Can I just go to the concert?
Oh, a lot of people do that.
Can I?
I mean, so I've been at these events, and there's the golf crowd. As the golf crowd is filing out, people start coming in for the concerts, and a lot of good looking people dressed really nice, you know, nice cars. It's like a completely different crowd. Now, some people stay on, but there's definitely folks who are coming just for the concert. So you could get away with that, Ryan, for sure.
Maybe that's how they're making a little bit of this money back, is they're having these concerts.
I don't know, man.
I mean, yeah. I would not even begin to know how much, you know, Snoop Dogg and Travis Scott, more especially because he's just a little more mainstream now. Like, you have to pay them in order to get them to play at your event. I mean, it has to be in the seven digits, would be my guess. Or in the high sixes.
Now, do they charge a separate admission fee, or is that part of your golf package?
No, I don't know. That's a better question for Alan. Yeah. I don't know.
I've never seen just the concert advertised, but I think what happens is you buy the golf ticket and you just go only to the concert. In other words, you know, so you're paying, you use the discount codes and you can get your day of golf for $50 or $75. But in fact, all you're doing is going to the concert, which is still cheap. I mean, to go to, you know, if that was at the, you know, Levi Stadium in San Francisco, that ticket would be $300. So for that concert. So, yeah, you could definitely
use not 25 and you're going to Travis Scott for like 68
exactly.
bucks.
Exactly.
And speaking of Kevin Na, how about Kevin Na having the flu, withdrawing and shaking everybody's hand on his way out to the night. Yeah. I mean, what in the hell is he doing? Like, oh, I got the flu, guys. I don't really feel good. And then shaking everybody's hand and leaving.
Yeah, that was, you know, bad.
Ryan, I think you make a very good point about Eminem and Travis Hill, you know, playing this golf tournament, because to me that dovetails with what I've thought all along, which is I think this is a Saudi effort to look Western, to look mainstream, and to look like something they haven't looked like for the last, you know, 10,000 or so years. And I think it's very effective. And I think when people say, you know, oh, they're going to get tired of losing money, I don't think they're going to get tired of losing money, because there's a lot of money to be made in looking Western.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree. Honestly, like, I mean, it's a really good concert. People would want to go to that concert could care less where it comes from, you know.
Yeah, sadly. Right. Okay, so here we are. It's like the week in golf, nobody watched the LIV tournament, and yet we can't stop talking about LIV, because it just blots out the sun. But there was a great tournament on the PGA Tour, as far as, I don't know, great's an overstatement. There was an interesting tournament on the PGA Tour. They're over in Japan, the Zozo. We had a Ricky Fowler sighting. You know, he's fired his caddy, his coach. He's reinventing himself, and he played great for 54 holes, had the lead. He didn't get it quite across the line, but, you know, second place finish, he had a T6 earlier. It seems like Ricky Fowler is on the road to recovery, which, you know, he's always been the butt of various jokes because he hasn't won that much given his station in the game and all the endorsements and everything, but it's hard to root against Ricky Fowler. I mean, he conducts himself with great class and dignity, and he's very giving of his time and of himself. And I think everyone's happy to see Ricky Fowler back. What was your guys' take on his performance?
I like Ricky Fowler. I love the way he plays. I love the way that, you know, the speed and the lightness of he's light on his feet. And I find him very pleasant to talk to. But 54 holes is not 72. And, you know, the last time he was in contention when Rory won in Vegas, that would probably be well over a year ago now. You know, it was the same kind of thing. He played some really good golf through about 67 holes. But, you know, for those of us who grew up on 72 holes for tournament golf, just as fans, not I'm saying playing it, 72 holes, there's something about it. So if you really are back, first off, you're winning. And if you're not winning, you're playing off. If you're not playing off, you're there through 72 holes. So there must still be things that are very much wrong. The swing's always been sort of funky, you know. I don't really know. I'd be rooting for him too. I think it's admirable because to see what he's doing, because it does take a lot of work to get to where he is. I imagine that it does. And I would think he's got a lot of money in the bank and not a lot of incentive except for the desire to play good golf. That would be my guess, really, really from afar.
I have never been a huge Ricky Fowler fan. But it kind of changed, I think it was 2 years ago at the U.S. Open qualifier. He was in a second alternate playoff, and it was like 10 for 2, and it was held the next morning. There's literally no reason that Ricky Fowler should have showed up, like zero. I mean, just zero. A, that he went to the qualifier, and B, that he thought enough to like show up for the second alternate playoff, and it was like mad respect. The dude showed up, talked to people. A guy actually dunked it from the fairway on the first playoff hole to end it pretty quickly, and like mad respect. He obviously, I think it was pretty well rumored. You guys are better and in the know on this more, that he was at least offered and could have gone to LIV. I think it was kind of a like pretty obvious person to go after, very popular, not playing well, in danger of even losing his status. It would have seemed like an easy out for Ricky at that point, and he didn't go. And now he's scrambling back. I mean, he just doesn't, like Michael said, I'm sure he doesn't need the money. And so mad respect for him to come back and do this. I agree, Michael, obviously not all the way back, but I mean, hell, he basically lost his card last year. So the second place finish will go a long way in just keeping his card so we can continue this quote unquote comeback. But, I mean, in the fall events have been pretty good. I'm indifferent about Keegan Bradley, but, Thigala was in the top 10, Hovland in the top 10, Xander in the top 10. Obviously not many people here really cared about it just because of the time difference. But another good fall event for the PGA Tour at a time they obviously need some.
Yeah. I mean, I love Keegan Bradley. He's always been one of my go-to guys. Like he's a great quote. He's very funny. He's very smart, and he's not afraid to say things. So I was happy for him, you know, first win since 2018. And, you know, you forget the guy's a major championship winner. He was a Ryder Cup monster there for a couple of years, and he still has a lot of golf in front of him. So, there's something compelling. It's actually, we mentioned Kevin Na. It's a little bit like watching Kevin Na. You know, you can see the angel and the demon on their shoulders out there. You know, Keegan's so fidgety and so nervous, and just the weight of it all shows the strain. And that's why I think it's fun to watch him. I know his ornate pre-shot routine is a bit much and is not great TV, but there's something about that to me, like it builds the tension. Like, I wouldn't want to watch it every week, but when he's in contention once or twice a year and you can see his discomfort, it's so palpable. There's something about that I find very compelling, even as it is a little maddening.
Point of LIV versus everything always ends up as LIV versus the PGA Tour. But Keegan did an interview. I think he was FaceTiming his wife and the tour recorded it. I mean, he was bawling, couldn't get through it. And then flash back to the LIV interview with Brooks. And the guy, I mean, they have to stop this. They have to stop the propaganda. It really is ridiculous. The guy led the question with, "I know you've won majors, but this has to be a big moment in your career." I'm like, the Jetta, whatever this is called, is a big moment. And Brooks is like, you know, I mean, Brooks is like, yeah, yep, kind of. But I think, you know, Keegan's, it's such, I'm not a PGA Tour lackey. For the people that are going to say this, I've had my brawls with the PGA Tour. All of us have, on them more than me, the other two on this thing. But like, it means something to win. It is the struggle back. Like Keegan hasn't won in a long time. And to your point, Alan, that's what Brooks's win should have been. Like it is a big point in golf that Brooks Koepka, at times one of the best golfers in the entire world, is back. And in his interview, he said, you know, I wasn't sure I was going to play again. There was a minute there that I wasn't ever going to tee it up again. That should be a huge moment. And it just wasn't. And it was not in the whole golf world, but to Keegan, it was a huge moment. And that's where, I mean, it's back to the same point. I just don't know how LIV builds that ever with their current setup, because all of the guys are super rich. And I just don't understand it.
If it's not a really big deal to the player himself to win, you know, how can we possibly expect it is for us? I mean, that's the starting point. The beauty of the majors is there's such a yin and yang going on with them. The players care a lot, therefore we care a lot. We care a lot, therefore the players care a lot. The sponsors care a lot. History cares a lot. It's all in one big stew, and that's the beauty of them. And, you know, as we've discussed, and Alan made this point last time we were together, and it was a great point, you know, the majors will only become more important out of this, and that will be good for golf. Or maybe, Ryan, pardon me if it was your point, but, you know, and then the qualifiers for the major, no, I think it was, Alan, the qualifiers for the U.S. Open, the qualifiers for the British Open, and maybe the PGA of America will have to develop a similar kind of qualifying system, but that will sprinkle down, that will, you know, would it trickle down, and become more important as well. You know, I'm with you. And Keegan Bradley, you know, the emotion that he's brought to his golf all through his career has been, I've rooted for him for that reason. I've also admired the fact that, you know, he spat like crazy, and he had one conversation, I don't know with whom, but one PGA Tour official that it was a bad look, and he quit cold turkey. And that is not, that's not an easy habit to quit. So I've always admired him for that one little thing.
Who quit?
No, no, talking about chewing tobacco?
Keegan used to chew tobacco?
I don't know that he chewed. I think he just spat like crazy.
He's like a nervous tick. Yeah.
During that whole weird pre-shot thing that he did.
Keegan Bradley once caddied for Mark Baldwin at Q School. Can you imagine the downgrade of having me on the bag?
How did that?
And then once having Keegan, they're friends. I cannot. It's a very, very good story that will leave for Mark Baldwin, because I'm not sure how much I can tell and how much I cannot. It's an amazing, great story. Mark had to pick him up, and he was not. Anyway, it's a long story. It's Mark's to tell, and it's a great story, and it needs to be told on a podcast.
Okay, I'm filing that away for future reference.
Here's the deal. Alan, I refuse to forget this. I have got to know the Australian story, like, right now. The 10-minute Australian story.
Oh, from last time. Oh, God. What was the context? I mean, we were talking about, like,
I don't even remember how
we got it. Just misadventures on the golf beat. Okay, so this is the deal. This is, like, 98 or 99. It was 99. So, remember, Aaron Baddeley as an amateur was an absolute legend. He won the Australian Open. He was just one of the best teenage golfers of all time. So I want to go down and do a story. And, you know, back in those days, if you're going all the way to Australia, it's like you had to come up with another story. So Kari Webb was also on Almighty Terror. So I was like, I'll do Kari because we've never really done a big story on her. Great. Perfect. So I guess I had a cell phone, but it was like early days of cell phone, email, all that. So I went to an LPGA event and I talked to Kari's mom, Evelyn, and I said, okay, I'm going to the Australian Masters, and then I'm going to come up to air, and I want to spend some time with you, because I knew Kari was going to be there at that time. She said, great, lovely, here's the home number, you know, I'll write it down in my book, I'll see you then. And so it was done. It was like, so I fly to Australia, and obviously not a short trip. I go right to the Australian Masters, and word is Baddeley just WD'd because he had like a horrible flu. I was like, damn. So bad luck, whatever. I talked to other players about him. I went out and watched some golf. But this was like, he was in bed for days. And so his dad took me out. His parents felt terrible. They took me all around. And I met Aaron for 7 seconds. He walked out of his room in his underwear. And like, he pulled a Kevin Na, shook my hand. He said, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry you came all this way. I'm going to have to go back to bed. And so literally I went to Australia to do Aaron Baddeley and only saw him for maybe 9 seconds tops. But I was still able to do a lot of good reporting. And it turned out to be a good story because the people around him are excellent talkers, but that, you know, that happens sometimes. So then I go to Ayr, which is this tiny little town in the middle of nowhere. And, I get to my hotel and I call Evelyn, and she says, oh, goodness gracious. Oh, that's not going to work. I said, I'm sorry, what? She said, yes. No, Kari's not going to be able to see you at all. I said, I just flew here from California. It's really far away. We had already agreed on this. She said, yes, I'm terribly sorry. I should have rang, but there's no way you can see Kari. Kari had come home with a romantic partner and they did not want to be seen in public. And so I, And so I was like, okay, I'm here. I got to write a story. So I was everywhere I'd go in town, I'd go to the diner. Oh, Kari was just here. And I'd go to the golf club. Oh, did you see Kari? She just left. And it was like a Seinfeld. Everywhere I went, I just missed Kari by 10 minutes. And while I was there, and of course, again, the parents felt bad. So they took me around and whatever. And there was the one movie house in Ayr, which is actually where Rob and Evelyn, the parents, had met when they were little kids, had fallen in disrepair and been shuttered. Kari had bought it. They were reopening it. Rob and Evelyn were doing all the work themselves, basically. And if you remember Kari's swing coach, he had been in a horrible accident. He was in a wheelchair. And so everyone, again, was very colorful. And I wound up writing that story as like as a screenplay because of the movie connection. And it's one of the best things I've ever done. But so I went to Australia to do two features.
Never saw
Kari, and I saw Aaron Baddeley for one handshake, and that was it. But I wrote two big ass features, and you have to be clever in this profession. But I mean, you talk about a disappointing trip. It worked out in the end. I liked both stories, but man, that was
bad. When you went to that movie theater, did it open up while you were there? Or was it planning?
No, it was still and. I think if I'm remembering correctly, Rob had Kari's father had a background in construction. So he was in there, you know, like working on it. It was still kind of somewhat gutted, but, you know, they described it was a big deal in those days. It was like the only movie theater for hundreds of miles, apparently, like, and you know, you'd get dressed up and you'd go on the weekends and it was like a big deal. And so, it was kind of cute that,
do you think the place is still open? How do you spell
AYR? That's a good question. I wouldn't be able to answer that. I haven't thought about it in a while, but
Alan, what would you do if the family or the agent or somebody would have said to you, we'll make Kari available to you. You can write her up. Anything about her private life involving a romantic relationship is off limits. What would you have said in that situation?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, again, because I probably would have said yes because I was there and I would have liked to have spent some time with her. And I think Kari is a very cool person. And, you know, her romantic life was complicated. You know, when she showed up on the LPGA as this phenom, her fiance was caddying for her and they had a big acrimonious breakup. And then I think her dating life went in a different direction and that was in the tabloids in Australia and whatever. So in the end, I probably wasn't going to write about it anyway. You know, Sports Illustrated in the 90s was pretty uptight place and it wasn't really that germane. I mean, of course it is because our romantic lives are a big part of who we are and for athletes as well. And so I'm not sure I would have had the confidence back then to really get into it, especially since they didn't want me to and had made that clear. So on the other hand, I don't like people telling me what to do. So I might have turned them down. I don't know. That's a tough one. The young me probably would have taken the deal.
Yeah, no, I mean, the reason, and this won't surprise anybody, the reason I asked the question is, you know, one thing I think we've all seen in just like that little Phil exchange is that people think that there are black and white rules for what we do. And really, it's so on the margins and in the gray, and there is no right and wrong answer. Actually, you've got to feel your way through every situation, and a lot of it has to do with trust and history, or lack of trust and lack of history. And in this case, you know, there was no history. You know, you and Phil had a particular type of history, and you know, and that affected how that whole thing went down. You know, I don't know what Phil was thinking, but I know that you were thinking, I've been trying to reach this guy, now he's finally called me and I'm using it. And, you know, as I wrote, I think you were totally entitled to do that. But people, I'm not saying that they should, but it's hard for people to understand what these real life situations are like.
Yeah, well, that's well said. I mean, so much of our job is interpersonal. And Ryan, you know this too, because your DMs and your texts, people tell you all kinds of crazy stuff all the time. Sometimes they're okay if you use their name. Sometimes it has to be anonymous. Sometimes you fact check it. It turns out that it's not as black and white as they said. I mean, every situation is kind of complex in its own way. And you have to just I mean, there are rules and there's guidelines, but like, I mean, it's very situational and you sort of have to follow your heart on these things. I mean, what is your thought on that, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, I can relate it. Obviously, you guys have tons and tons of more experience, but the Dustin Manning and I relationship is kind of like that. You know, Dustin called me hundreds of times. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of times, and told me stuff off the record, on the record, and I have to find that balance of giving him respect because at the end of the day, I want the story. You know, I want him to feel comfortable enough to keep calling me, right? Because I want the story. So it's just not as black and white. Like, he said he would say things and then say, Ryan, I really meant that to be off the record. And I'm like, okay, you know, and I kind of have to find the balance of, you know, do I let him go or do I not let him go? Or is that really off the record? And so I just navigated it on a like call to call basis. And, you know, it's, you guys have dealt with it 100,000 more times than I have. It's just, you just navigate it as you go. That relationship, I just navigated on a call-to-call basis, basically.
Dustin Manning is the guy who put up the Big Money Classic. He's a mini tour promoter, operator who has a history of not paying his players. And Ryan has been chasing the story for a while, and he's a very slippery character.
Side note, the guy that DM'd you DM'd me, and I talked to him on the phone today, and he says, my wife signed up and lost $3,000. Do you think that I'm going to get the money back? And I'm like, no, I do not.
Yeah.
No, I think you can. He told me that he was going to pay one girl a month. And I was like, yeah, he's not. He's not going to pay anybody. So I would write that off pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the off the record thing is fascinating because, again, if someone says it and you agree to it, then that goes in a black box. And as I've said this previously, like the three most explosive things I know to be true about Phil Mickelson are not in the book. And each of them would have been international news, like probably would have dwarfed the Saudi stuff in some ways, but they're not in the book because they were told to me off the record. And I always honor those agreements. But in the case of Phil, he never asked to go off the record. I never consented to it. Now, people have said, do you think that he thought he was off the record? I mean, I don't know what Phil was thinking. I'm not a mind reader, and I'm not sure when Phil picked up the phone to call me, he intended to tell me everything he told me. But it was a long, emotional phone call, and he was getting worked up, and we were going back and forth. And that's, some would say that's the art of interviewing, is to keep getting people to tell you things. And I didn't entrap him. You know, he was doing this. He called me. This was of his own free will. But once we're on the phone and he's going, I'm not going to stop him. And, you know, I guess I could have said, Phil, are you sure you want to say that? You know, but he's a big boy. He's a very smooth operator when it comes to reporters. And he knew I was writing this freaking book about him. So if he's on a monologue that's got a lot of heat to it, I'm not going to cut him off and say, Phil, are you sure you want to say that? Yeah, that's just not my role. I'm there to listen. And so did he say more than he intended to? It's possible, but you know, that's on him, not me. So it's a fascinating subject. It could probably fill up a whole semester of journalism school, like how this whole thing is played out. But ultimately, you know, as I go back to, like you're saying, Michael, you have to follow your conscience. You have to follow your heart. Like, I know that I've treated Phil very fairly. And I know that when he called me, he had an agenda. And since he never asked to go off the record, like every word's going in the book. Like that will just always be my position on this. And as he said, we're going to have to agree to disagree, but Phil knows the truth. I know the truth. And it's been quite a ride ever since that phone call.
Well, Jake, the easiest social clips you've ever had in your life, those last minute and a half right there. Just chop that up and watch the downloads come in.
Well,
second of all, I do want to address that Lou Stanger, I think is his name, been very nice to me. Seems to be a nice guy. He's just hung up on the fact that Alan didn't record this phone conversation. And I will say only from my own experience that two people on this call will have a billion more experience than I do. If someone wants to talk, you just shut the fuck up and let them talk. Michael Bamberger told me that. And like, if I met a person that I want to talk to and he wants to talk on the record in an elevator, I'm not recording it. I'm just letting him talk. And Dustin Manning used to call me all the time, middle of the night, on the record. I didn't go, hey, Dustin, let me go downstairs and get on my computer so I can record this. And he's like, just spilling beans that I want to hear. I'm just letting him talk. And so it's just.
Yeah, that's all well said. Yeah, Lou Stanger, he sent me dozens of DMs on the subject. He's a very, very interesting personality. But I like to record stuff in general when I can. This was a weird deal because I was driving on I-5 when Phil called me. And when he had originally texted me asking to speak, I mean, he said he wanted to talk about media rights and name, image, likeness issues and that sort of thing. That was a short text I got from him. And that's what his lawyer tried to sign me up as a consultant on, which of course I turned down because that's a glaring conflict of interest. So, you know, I thought it was going to be a boring conversation about, you know, how the tour is marketing its players. That was how it was kind of billed to me. So, if I'd known how incendiary it was going to be, I definitely would have recorded it. Also, the call dropped like 3 or 4 times because I was driving on I-5, so we had to call each other back. And it was just kind of a little messy from a tech standpoint. But
just for the record, Jake texted me 20 minutes ago to wrap it up. That's right. So, hey, Jake, no, we're not fucking wrapping it up. We might talk. What are you going to say, Michael? What ran Lou Hinkle? Well, what about Lou?
I think you might be referring to Lon Hinkle. just as a quick side note, so on the right before the PGA Championship, I was at a filling station right outside of Tulsa. The phone rang. It says caller unknown. I wasn't expecting any call from anyone in particular, and it was Trump calling me directly with no intermediary. And Trump and I know each other well, though I hadn't talked to him for years. And I was interviewing him. I was definitely interviewing him, but because he's comfortable with me. He was starting to talk about someone in a very personal way. And I said, you know, Mr. President, you know, I just want to remind you that I'm interviewing you. So tell me stuff that I can use. And I'm just giving this as a little illustration of real life stuff. Now here's a guy who's been interviewed thousands and thousands of times. And there's a response to that. So I said, you know, give me stuff that I can use. You know, that's just sort of like real everyday language about how these things play out. And then Trump said, well, you know, you clean it up. You know, when I'm talking to a reporter, you know, I might just say something and, you know, you just sort of clean it up. You know, if I'm speaking in public, of course, it's perfect. But anyway, but the point being is that people want these phrases like it's on the record, it's off the record. You can use this, you can't use that. But the give and take of real life conversation, as you're finding out, Ryan, with talking to Mr. Manning, is just different. And I think what Phil forgot was that Alan's primary obligation is to tell readers what Phil Mickelson's actually like. And Phil was serving it up on a platter. What kind of reporter would Alan be if he didn't use that? But for whatever reason, Phil forgot that or chose to forget that or didn't think, you know, I don't know. We don't know what he was thinking. And that's, of course, part of what's going on here. But
yeah, we know he has some impulse control issues, right? Like that's been well documented. And he'd already said no to me 3 times much earlier. His agent had told him not to do it. But in the end, he just couldn't help himself. He had to call and tell me how smart he was. And he'd outfox Jay Monahan. He'd outfox Greg Norman. Like he just couldn't help it. All right. Well, we are going to follow the advice of Jake Muldowney, our producer, who is going to be a recurring character on this podcast. So the listeners will probably be interested to know that Jake was a longtime caddy at Band and Dunes. And that's how we actually all got to know him at the Uncle Tony Invitational. And but he had a dream of being in the golf media. He has a gift for a lot of the technical aspects. And so Jake produces this podcast, Poor Bastard, and he cuts all of our socials and he's sometimes,
and he's a Packers fan, it's a tough scene. I talked to Jake an hour before this, and it was, I mean, full on depression, full on. I'm somewhat concerned for him. I considered sending flowers. Glad to see him on. I mean, it's tough, t- tough scene for Jake.
Right? I think all Packers fans are obsessives, but Jake is the kind of Packers fan who dresses his dogs in Packers jerseys. So he's the lunatic fringe of Packers fans. But
anyway,
and it's funny that he texted you to wrap it up, not me. Very interesting. Noted, Jake.
Yeah, that is
noted.
Yeah, Jake.
All right. So this was a fire drill podcast. We'll be doing these every Sunday. More or less. And we appreciate you guys out there listening and sticking to the bitter end. I think we should recognize our corporate sponsors, Parpoint, who have produced the most interesting golf scoring app available. It's kind of a refreshing new way to play the game. And we would encourage you to download the app and test it out. It really adds a fun dimension. And of course, Dormy Workshop, they make beautiful handcrafted leather goods for whether the head covers or any other little goodies that will improve your life in different ways. So, and some of their collaborations with the Fire Pit can be found at our website. And I would encourage you to check that out as well. So thanks for letting us be in your ear, and for Ryan French and Michael Bamberger. This is Alan Shifnuck. We will be back at it again next Sunday with another fire drill. That's it.
I bet big and I played to win. Made a fortune when my ship came in. I ran the table, never thought I could fall. Then the winter time hit me like a cannonball. And now I can't shake this losing streak. Every road I take is a dead end street. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa,
and
hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.